Welcome to the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by X2 Comedy. If you're looking to get more out of your Shenandoah Valley experience, then this is the podcast for you. You'll meet interesting people, the comedians that perform here, and find out more about what you can do and see. Whether you live here or plan to visit, listen to explore what helps make up our unique slice of heaven. Now here's your host, Dawn Davis Womack.
Hello, laughers. I'm excited to introduce you to these three hilarious comedians, all based out of Virginia. Based out of the D.C. area, Patrick DeMarkey is an author and stand-up comedian. He grew up in the Shenandoah Valley before moving to D.C. after college with brief spurts in L.A. and New York City. He has performed in 21 cities around the U.S., as well as Vancouver, Canada, and Monterrey, Mexico. He speaks Spanish, knows a little bit of Arabic, and hopes one day to be fluent in five languages. Based out of Richmond, Paige Campbell is an X2 comedy fan favorite who has performed in several shows for us, as well as many more shows throughout Virginia and the East Coast for the last 8 years. He hosts a monthly show at Busky's Cider in Richmond, has a podcast, and draws cartoons. Based out of Chester, David Beck started as a road comic in 1994, performing weekly in comedy clubs across the country and has traveled the world on tour entertaining our military. Some of the notable clubs he's worked include the Ice House in Pasadena, California, Governors and Dangerfields in New York City, the Looney Bins, Crackers, the Comedy Case, Deja Vu, Charlie Goodnights, numerous improvs and funny bones, just to name a few. David has also been heard on Fox Sports Radio and made TV appearances on Sprint, Comedy Time Network, and Night Shift. Welcome to the show, Patrick, Paige, and David. It is so great to have all three of you here on the show today.
Hey, Dawn. Nice to meet you. Nice to see you. Thanks for having
me. Yes. Thanks for being here. Thanks for all of you being here.
Thanks for having us. I'm fired up.
Me too. How about you, Patrick?
Yeah, I'm stoked. This is really cool. By the way, this is my second Zoom-related appearance ever in my life.
Mine too. Oh, yeah. You really?
I've never had to really use it, so it's that's why I'm like adjusting everything from headphones to microphone. I'm like, what in the heck is going on here?
Does he sound like he's using a transistor radio to anybody else? He sounds
me a little bit too.
Yeah, it sounds like he's recording it out of an 18-wheeler.
I know. Yeah. That's the wonderful pleasure of working with Zoom, y'all. You only get to hear it, but
I can tell what you're saying, but
it, yeah. Yeah, that's the main thing. People can understand.
Sounds like you're part of a convoy over there.
Well, we're in for a good time, laughers. I can tell already. I love comedians. I think they're super fascinating. Every story is so unique and how they got started. So that's where I want to begin. Patrick, how did you get your start in stand-up?
I was like about to turn 28, and I'd started spending a lot of time in New York City visiting a buddy of mine that lived up there. And I eventually started going to just see some clubs and all that. And I remember after seeing it, it was one of those things that it kind of like always called to me. And I always just saw it as like a crazy idea. And then I started seeing open mics and I was like, oh hell, there's a bunch of people here that I've like never heard of before. I guess you can just go and do this, you know? So then I went down to DC, but in DC I had to like, it was bringer shows and I know what was going on. So I just spent a bunch of time trying to figure out how to get on a show. And then eventually I was like, all right, I got to make this happen. So I found five friends of mine that were willing to come watch me. Five of who I felt wouldn't shame me too much if I did absolutely terrible my first time. And I did it at a place called the Big Hunt in DC off of DuPont Circle, which unfortunately I don't think is there anymore either. But it was really cool. And then, after that first night, I definitely caught the bug. I loved it. It was really, really interesting. And then I moved it to New York probably 6 months later and was just trying to do open mics as often as possible while I was bartending and doing whatever I could to make the city work.
That's a great experience to go to New York City and do open mics up there. Did you feel like it was different than DC? And if so, how?
Oh, wildly, wildly different. Like I would not wish to speak ill of any city scene, but at the time DC only had maybe one night, one mic per week, and they were almost always bringer shows. Unless you were friends with the guy who ran it, you couldn't just go and get there, But then I went to New York and they didn't even have to know who I was, and I could go do three or four shows in a night if you could just run around the city and make it happen. They started at 5 PM and they went till 2 AM. So that was really, really cool. That scene was great. you were more often than not just performing to a room full of comedians or people who unexpectedly walked in a bar and were like, okay, who are these people talking? But it was a really, really neat time. And you got to just see like a plethora of people and of material. It was awesome.
That's really cool. I love that. How about you, Paige? How'd you get started in stand up?
Well, I mean, like it started like, I mean, the way it starts for pretty much anyone, I guess, where they're like really into like watching comedy. I was like a comedy nerd like in high school, and I started really young because I'm from, I guess people in Harrisburg would know Waynesboro. Not everyone would know Waynesboro, Virginia, but in Harrisonburg, people know Waynesboro. So I'm from Waynesboro, and the timing was just right because I had told a bunch of friends that I wanted to try it, and then a buddy went to a venue that's not around anymore called the Hotspot, but he saw that they were doing a comedy night, and he told me, and I was like, well, I said I want to try it, so I went up and tried it. And yeah, I feel like I'm the kind of guy who if I try something and it doesn't go well, I just won't do it again. But it went like decent enough that I was like, okay, yeah, this is something I can do, and I just haven't really stopped doing it.
No, you haven't, and I'm glad for that. How about you, David?
I was dared.
What?
I was the quietest kid in school. I couldn't do a book report, couldn't talk in front of anybody. Started working at a restaurant, had friends from high school working with me, and one of the managers or supervisor's husband was a local comedian at the old comedy club above the bus stop. And they dared me to do it, and then I stupidly, I guess, said yes. And so I gave myself 3 months to put stuff together, and with a little bit of his guidance, went up and tried. I was 19. I went up and tried it and did 4 times on stage. First time was actually not horrible, from what I remember. The next few times were of sheer death, and then I kind of got out of it. I kind of started twice the same way. I stopped after those 4 times for quite a few years, and then another friend of mine dared me again to go back up at 24. And the deal was then if I went up and tried it again, he would too. And he'd never been on stage before. He went on stage one time just to get me back on stage.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And never did it again. I went up and I made my mind up at that point to do it every week until I made a living. So I was from Richmond to Virginia Beach. It was first Williamsburg, where I went up the second time, and then drove there a few weeks to do open mic, then drove from Richmond to Virginia Beach at my home club there. The Thurgood Inn Comic Club is no longer there. Every week, Wednesday and Thursdays, doing open mic every week, working my day job at the time, driving back and forth. And I did that for years.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was full time probably after that, about 6 years later.
You were grinding.
Yeah, I was not a natural comic. I learned everything. Public speaking was horrified me. So I learned everything on stage, basically by going up and suffering.
And it paid off, which is great.
Yeah, it's been the best thing ever happened to my life, basically.
Oh, yeah, I feel that way, too. Even the challenging times, I still feel yeah. that way.
I said comedy's given me everything in my life, and it's taken just as much.
Yep, I agree with that 100%. Yeah. And all the comics are laughing right now because they totally feel that. Oh, my God. Okay, Patrick, this question is for you. You speak Spanish. Yes, you speak Spanish, know a little bit of Arabic, and hope to one day be fluent in 5 languages. What are the other languages you hope to be fluent in, and why this goal in particular?
So I'll start first with like why. So growing up, my grandfather was always known jokingly as being a dude who could speak like 7 languages, but couldn't remember his phone number. And he had grown up like he grew up in Switzerland, where like naturally you spoke 3 just before you were like 12 years old, because that's how it was. And then he lived in Africa for a while, and just, I remember just growing up and thinking that was like absurd. It was like obtainable, but still kind of crazy. And then I was also just really jealous because most of the people on my mom's side of the family could speak French to each other at the dinner table, and I didn't understand a word of it. And I still don't, you know, maybe like 10 phrases here and there. So when I was in school, like it was just became a thing that after like 20, I was like, yo, I got to do this because I can't understand a damn thing. And then I started working in a bar and I didn't understand most of my coworkers. I was up in the DC area. And so I just started telling them later, like, just talk to me, talk to me, talk to me. And I just started picking it up. And yeah, I mean, I say five because seven sounds crazy, but part of it was that once I started to travel, I really enjoyed being able to go somewhere and not having to ask for help in order to communicate. You know, I mean, that like enriched the experience of going somewhere by tenfold. And when I was like, when I turned 30, I was like, oh, like I've basically at 20 didn't speak any Spanish. Now I can like travel around on my own. I was like, I got to pick another one. And so I thought about Arabic, which would be a cool one because it's kind of, you know, encompasses so much of this part of the world, you know, from the southern part of the Mediterranean all the way to, you know, the peninsulas of Saudi Arabia. And I also at the time, again, was just around a lot of people who spoke Arabic. And I was like, all right, let me just start practicing. So I remember just waiting tables and just trying to learn phrases of how to do it. And I was like, okay, what do you want to drink? Blah, blah, blah. And French I'd love just because it'd be cool to be able to like, you know, one day to show up to my aunt's house and just start spitting out French to her. You know, but there's no real like utility or anything. It's not like I'm going to go use it in other areas. And the fifth one, I'm really torn between loving the idea of Japanese because Japan would just be so cool to travel to. And I'd love to be able to go around there and just, I think their history is really cool, but that does seem kind of like wild to me. So something like Russian maybe too, because that's also a language where I've just worked around a bunch of people that speak it, even down in the valley, as you probably know, like there's a ton of Russian people.
There are.
You know, yeah. And I remember I worked at the Applebee's there when I was in college. And I remember having a few nights where I'd be like, yo, how do I have eight tables of Russian people here? Like, what is this? I didn't take the opportunity then to do. Sorry about that fifth one once I can get the other one kind of down. But I would say that like Russian or Japanese would be like high on my list as far as like what I think I'd be genuinely curious about.
Very so, cool. So a lot of your interest is you like to travel the world and you want to be able to connect with people more directly.
Yeah. Oh, I'd absolutely love that. Cause okay. I traveled with a friend who didn't speak Spanish. And it was then that I realized when we were together, how different his experience was compared to mine while we were there. And I was like, oh man, I was like, I gotta like, just keep doing this. Because even just little simple things, like all he could do was request help. And then that was it. And so, yeah. And it also just made working a lot easier too, because you know, you get a lot of free food if in a restaurant if you can speak Spanish. It's really, it's highly beneficial to my diet, that's for sure.
Well, now I know what my second language will be.
I recommend it.
You know, I love that answer. I went, you know, it's interesting you would say that. I had an experience like your friend when I went to Poland with my grandmother. I went with her to Poland. It was a 3-week trip. 21-day trip, and mm-hmm. she speaks fluent Polish. And I can, you know, that's I was wild. Just envious of her being able to just communicate so freely. And I felt like your friend, like, all I can do is ask where the bathroom is and rely on her so much to do the communication for us, you know, and ask for directions, pretty much anything. Yeah.
Well, and lastly, not only that, but it's like, I remember the first time that I was able to use my Spanish to realize by just listening that this taxi cab driver was trying to screw me over on the money, you know, because the guy in the other chair who was from Costa Rica was totally getting a different price than me to go to the same place. And that's the unfortunate part about traveling abroad is like, I was a broke gringo. I was not a rich gringo. You know, I was like down there with no money. And so when people try to like, you know, get way more out of me, I was like, oh, I don't have that, you know? I'm not someone who can just hand you $100 bill. Like I actually like, I need this $5 price here, you know? So it enabled me to like be aware that I'm like, you know, I could be on a level playing field sometimes, especially on the financial side of things. Like that probably saved me hundreds of dollars, you know, on trips time and time again.
Now we know what his real motivation is, folks.
No. Multi-layered.
Yeah, totally multi-layers. I totally get that. Yeah. Now, Paige, you don't just have stand-up as a talent. You also draw cartoons. What kind do you draw? And when did you know you had a talent for it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I draw all kinds of different ones. I've always, like, enjoyed drawing silly cartoons. I guess I realized in, like, middle school I started doing it in, like, high school just to make my friends laugh. And it was silly. I'm not good enough. I always liked like taking art class, but like I'm not good enough at art that I can draw something without a punchline. Like I can draw just fine enough that it needs a punchline. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. I like it as a different outlet because even though I love stand up, you get that immediate reaction. There are some ideas that you have that are fun and silly, but I don't think really work as like a stand up bit. So it's a different way to get get jokes out there. That's all I want to do is get jokes out there in different ways. So some of them are one panel, some of them are multi-panel. I just put up jokes.
That's really cool. Yeah. So you feel both of you two authors, you feel, we didn't quite get there yet. So let's go to you, Patrick, about that. I know what, I'm going to get to that. Before I do, laughers, hold on, because we got an author here. But I have a question for David first. I got ahead of myself because you guys are very
I'm not the author this year.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know, my human is showing, laughers. My human is showing. But I want to ask David this question first, then we'll get to that. David, you've performed stand-up for our military in Japan and South Korea. What has that experience been like, and did you have to make any adjustments due to cultural differences?
Well, it kind of blends into Patrick and learning his languages. Going to Japan and South Korea, a little difficult, not speaking either language. And I did notice that they tended to like you more if you even attempted to, they would smile if you attempted to speak Japanese or Korean. And so that was nice. But as far as the shows, it was mostly military bases, so not much had to change. And most of it was for, in bars for soldiers. So, and the guy I was working with, we were co-headlining, and the guy I was working with is a very dirty comic. And I was I'm more of a cleaner comic. And when we go to the bar shows, he would do fantastic. And if I was in front of him, it was great. Following him made it more difficult because they tend to like the dirtier stuff more. So I had to juice it up a little bit to follow him. And then we were in Seoul, South Korea, and we were doing an expat club. There was like 13 different nationalities there. And it was more like a corporate. And then I went up first and the show was great. It was my first really good show of the trip because it wasn't a bar setting. And they were really having a good time. And I come off stage and I see him pacing like I was all the other shows. Like, oh my God, that was your show. How am I going to follow that? And I was like, dude, you're fine. And he did something, one of the smartest things I've ever seen. He went up on stage and he goes, I am different than David. I'm dirtier. I can try to clean it up and do more of that, or I can just do my show as is. And he kind of diffused it, and it went fine for him as well. So not a whole lot of change. The travel was ridiculous. The first day was 18 hours of travel.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Flew to Chicago, Chicago to Tokyo, then Tokyo to Hiroshima, Hiroshima to Iwakuni. Just by the time we got there, I was just dead. And so we luckily had a day off after that. The show was later that next day, so we had a day to recoup. It was a whirlwind. It was like 13 days, 12 flights. And going to South Korea is one of the most dangerous places to drive in. And luckily, one of the most dangerous places, the most accidents. And one of the, we were traveling through South Korea and we had a cab and I fell asleep. I was tired and I woke up and the other comic goes, you awake? I said, yeah. He goes, good, because I almost died three times. Oh my God. I was like, oh, that's good. And I think I'll go doze back off now so I don't see this. Yeah, it was a little bit more.
But I think that would have woke me up. You're a hard sleeper, David.
Yeah, I am. Thank goodness. And Japan was interesting because I'm a car guy. So all the cars that we can't get over here, they had.
Oh, nice.
And the guy I was with wasn't. And I'm like, ooh, look at their skyline and this and that and this. And it was really, it was a good experience.
Yeah, because you work in a body shop, don't you? Or an auto shop? Or
I have, yes.
Okay, yeah. So you really, you're a car person.
Yes, I am. I've restored old Pontiacs and
stuff like that. I've
drag raced and street raced and done all that stuff too.
See the things you find out of about people when you ask questions. Yeah. Now, what is your favorite car you restored?
I did a 66 Pontiac Tempest Custom.
Oh.
55 cubic inch engine and all that in it. Built it from the ground up.
How long did that take?
It took about a year and a half.
Wow.
Yeah, to do it. I bought it as a $500 junker against my mom's permission at 19. Took me about 21. I got it done. It was so different. People from work restaurant I worked at. They saw the car before. It was bronze with like a tan interior, barely ran. When they pulled it up to the window of the restaurant, I said, "What do you think?" They go, "Where is it?" I said, "What do you mean?" It was right in front of the window, but it was white with black interior and all completely redone. And they had no idea that that was the car.
Total transformation.
Yeah, it was the guy that helped me build it. We're still friends. He's restored like 15, 20 GTOs over the years. Wow. So he was the guru that kind of taught me how to work on them. And nice. I'm helping him build another one now, 25 years later.
Oh, okay. Another Pontiac?
Another Pontiac. He's got a 68 Le Mans. He's doing up in Harrisonburg.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So maybe you can connect when you come up here.
Oh, yeah. I just came through there, went to Lurie Caverns this past weekend and drove through and then stopped by. And he's doing his car from the ground up, too.
Oh, that is so super cool. I want to see that sometime. Remember that, right, David. Okay, yeah. Take me up on that. For real. Okay. I want to do it. Okay, cool. Patrick, hey, listen. Now back to the author business. So you are an author as well, and you have written a book. What is your book about, and where can we get it?
So when I was 27, 28, I took a road trip through Central America with a few guys that I knew that were actually from the Valley area. And they'd never really traveled outside the U.S. None of them spoke Spanish. And because the dude knew me from high school, he was like, "Hey, man," he's like, "I'd rather, if I'm going to pay some translator, I'd rather pay you." He's like, "You want to come down for this?" I was like, "Absolutely." So our trip got, rerouted due to a bunch of terrible mistakes with planes, to where we ended up like having to fly to a different country to get to our original destination. And I was like, if we're going to just spend 4 days waiting, why not drive from that country to the other country? You know, like, we've driven across country before. It's no big deal. We're on the, how it is in the Valley. You drive 45 minutes to go to your girlfriend's house. It's like, whatever. So, I was like, it's really not like that unfeasible. So now, granted, if you were to like, look, there weren't great options. So we were supposed to fly to San Jose, Costa Rica. We ended up flying into Panama City, Panama instead, which is on the furthest end of Panama you could want to be in if you're trying to get to Costa Rica. And then during that time, obviously, I just had, tons of neat experiences. And I decided to write an adaptation of that trip as it revolved around many different characters. And I just threw in a bunch of like little things along the way that I kind of remembered, because that obviously, nothing is based entirely on truth. And so I threw in a bunch of stuff that had happened to me over the years while traveling abroad, where I was like, "Oh man, I remember what this like when I didn't know this and I didn't know that." And I was like, what if I just threw all that into one thing, kind of like putting your act out there. It's like all your best stuff into one experience. So I wrote that book. One cool thing that really did happen while we were there is out of like a happenstance, we actually met the president of Panama on our like first night down there. He was out at a restaurant like maybe a block from us, and then they were leaving, and we happened to leave at the same time, and some waitress was like, "Yo, do you know who that is?" We're like, "Absolutely not." And we got to talk to him. He was cool. I got a picture with him, and it was fun. So I wrote an adaptation of that story.
Okay.
And the title is called From the Pages of a Finished Passport. Right. And that is supposed to indicate travel and all that whatnot. And you said you were curious about how that like integrated, or how that had anything to do with, or helped like stand up.
Yes. So
I definitely think like, I would imagine like anyone here who does like, a multitude of things, one kind of feeds the other and in many different ways. So when I was, writing the book, obviously certain parts of dialogue only were, conversations that aren't natural don't sound natural, mm-hmm. And when you're reading them, you're like, okay, cool. You're like, this doesn't flow properly. So I think about the order of things very differently, mm-hmm. because I realized that when I was going up sometimes, especially at an open mic, I would just go and just start talking, say this, that, and the other. And then I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. well, maybe that joke, I started to realize, well, maybe this joke would work better if earlier they had gotten this background piece of information about me. Mm-hmm. I'm like, why would you tell them about, this thing with your girlfriend's dog when they don't know that your, girlfriend is from South America? That matters to why this works, And so mm-hmm. I just started to see that there was, little details sprinkled here and there that would then later lead the reader to not have to ask a question or to have something seem more valid. And that just naturally kind of, worked in stand up as well. And then, I wouldn't call the book like funny. If there's a few moments that make you laugh, that's great, but it wasn't, an intention going through it. But it definitely helped to be doing two of those things at the same time, because I would look at it, okay, well, you do this on this end, why you're not doing this on that end? And I like that. And the difference though is, as he's saying, like kind of with, it's actually really cool when he was talking about like drawing comics, I'm super jealous of anybody that can actually draw detail. And he's so right, because you can get an immediate feedback. And that's the great part about stand-up, is that although it is from an audience and there's so many things going on there, you at least get someone to like, they laugh or they don't, or they look at you kind of weird. With the book, that was the most painful part about it, because you're writing 100 and something thousand words, and you're like, okay, well, I guess if you like this paragraph, it doesn't mean you're going to like the next paragraph. So there's so much involved in trying to figure out, like, well, what of this actually works? It was much harder to try and figure out those things than it was on stage, because you can just make quick adjustments, as opposed to here, if I mess something up, I might have to change five different things in the book later to be like, okay, I got to make sure I cover up that hole because that didn't work. And I didn't know that until they read it. So it's a really, the adapting of it from like the first draft to the final draft was way more difficult than I ever imagined it would be. And it was just but it was also really cool too, because you got to see feedback in a different manner. And the really interesting part that I found, which was like somewhat tragic and somewhat, you know, I understand it at the same time, is no one fakes laughter, or no one can fake laughter for that long, you know? So you knew pretty immediately if somebody did or didn't like you on stage. Mm-hmm. But with the book, I would find sometimes if people didn't like something, they don't know how to give feedback that isn't positive. And so sometimes you would just never hear from that person again, you know, mm-hmm. or it would take weeks, you know, you'd be like, yo, like, you know, I go on stage and I've had people literally not laugh at me for 5 minutes. I can handle it if you didn't like these two pages. I just need to know, you know? So that was honestly the hardest part about the editing, was getting people to give me honest feedback, which was interesting because the crowd is never shy to give you honest feedback.
That's true.
You know, and I was like, the disconnect was incredibly frustrating as I went along. It was like, I'm waiting on people to just tell me yes or no. And their silence speaks, but now I need to know what they'd prefer.
I hear that. So, yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, that's my, you know,
that was my thought on that. Yeah, that was a surprise part for you. And where can they buy the book and the name of it one more time?
It's on Amazon. You all can actually,
I'll put it in the show notes.
You got to see this here. But it's From Pages of a Finch Passport.
Yep.
Cool. It's on Amazon and on Kindle.
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes too. Hey,
awesome.
Paige,
appreciate that.
Yeah, you bet. Paige, you there?
I am. Yep.
All right. Cool. So, Paige, listen up. Question for you: You mm-hmm. hosted and performed in several creative comedy shows. Some of them have been with two other hilarious comics I know, Chris Allen and Winston Hodges. Which show with them has been your all-time favorite, and why?
All-time favorite is tough, because I mean there were so many. It's interesting when, like, you with comedy, like the comics that you meet and you know for a long time, because I've known those guys like for like 7-ish years at this point. It's pretty crazy. So I mean, there were so many good ones at the Southern. There are a lot that are memorable because they were horrible when we were all like newer to the area and we were trying to build the comedy scene in the area. Because that's what's great is like Chris came in and like with the help of Winston and like me and like a bunch of other regulars, we like all kind of like built the Charlottesville scene into like a bigger scene. Host Battle was always fun. I remember Host Battle was great. There was like one night where Chris like lifted me up on his shoulders. It was that stands out in my mind. It was really fun. But yeah, it's they all kind of blend together of just like so much fun, like so many classics. Winston's got video of some of it. It's what a great time.
Yeah, you guys do a lot of interesting things. He has the Winsmith games. We've done a bunch of those.
Yeah, there's Winsmith games, yeah. Right. Yeah, I like doing, like, I love regular stand-up, but it's fun to do, like, weird, different kind of shows. We used to do in Richmond, like, this thing called Monday Night Raw Haha, where it was, like, a roast thing, but it was, like, kind of, like, wrestling-themed. And, like, you would get into character. It's so fun to just dress up and do, like, a weird character thing, like a performance.
Okay, what was your weirdest character, Paige? Did you?
Yeah, me and Brandon Beswick. It's a good question.
Right?
Me and Brandon Beswick did, because he's a fat man, and I'm not. We did before and after. Like, we were out of an ad, and we were yelling at people. We were heels. That was good. Yeah, I like to, around Halloween, go up as, like, weird characters, too. I did a set as Mario last Halloween. That was cool.
Yeah, I love it. But you guys, what I like about those, I've only been to a couple of them in one of them, but they really stretch your creativity as a comic, you know, in live time, in real time.
Yeah.
Which is really, you know, if you have some improv background, it helps. But even if you don't, I have found that the experience makes you a better comic. So that's really cool. I'm glad you guys are doing that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, we got the most seasoned comic on this podcast interview that X2 Comedy has had to date, and that's David Beck with his 27 years experience. What? That's Sorry, I am too, David. And you've performed in several comedy clubs across the country over the years. What has been your favorite one so far? And what has been the craziest experience you've had to date?
Well, favorite club, that's easy. It's Laughs in Tucson, Arizona.
Oh, cool.
Still open. Phenomenal club. My first time there, I was driving from McAllen, Texas. And I left, the show started on Friday. I left me, I had a show in McAllen on Thursday. It's a 17-hour drive.
Wow.
Joe drove all the way there, about 100 miles outside of Tucson. My tire blows out. And I had a Focus SVT. It had aftermarket wheels on it. I bought it like that. I went to put the spare on. Well, the aftermarket lug nuts don't hold the spare too tightly. They're too long. Yeah. So the wheel was shaking back and forth, and I had to drive like 40 miles an hour for the next 110 miles because I couldn't get the wheels tight enough. And I had to get there. I got there an hour before showtime.
Oh gosh.
I go in, I'm frazzled, haven't slept or eaten in 24 hours.
Woo.
And I get there. I drink two Red Bulls, go in the bathroom, freshen up and jump on stage. Did two shows. I don't know what I said.
Oh my heaven.
I went fantastic. I was just, the crowds are amazing there and you could do no wrong. And I was like, wow, okay, this is awesome. And then the next night, two more shows, very fun. Every time I go there, it's a blast. The staff is amazing. Haven't been there in a little while, but since I'm back on the East Coast now from Missouri, it's a little harder to get there. Cause I could drive it before driving from Virginia. No, thank you.
No.
But phenomenal club. As far as craziest, there's kind of two that stick out. Show related, I was in Branson. I live near there, Branson, Missouri. I lived near there and I drove down and I was featuring and they had a fireworks convention by the river and the club was on the water and they didn't have curtains so you could see the water and everything. Well, the fireworks convention did not wait until the show was over. I was into my closer, just getting rid of my closer. They shot off everything they had. Just boom, you could see it. I mean, not just hear it, you could see it. And just people are just gazing out the window. And I do my closer and it gets nothing. You know, and I was the headliner in the back and say, "You want some of this?" And he went, "Nope, you're good. Keep going." They shot off for about 40 minutes. I had to stay on stage for about an hour and 20.
Oh, and my last God.
40 was just me talking about the fireworks, trying to make something work.
Oh, my God.
And then finally they were over and I brought the headliner up and he didn't have to deal with any of that.
Oh.
I was like, thanks for that.
Yeah.
The other one is not really show related. I was in the Bahamas working with a friend of mine and we were walking around after the show looking for some food, went off property of the resort we were at, and everybody tries to sell you drugs down there. So we're walking back, and I hear a guy behind us, hey, we're like, no, we're good, thanks. Then you hear click, click of a gun.
No.
Yeah, and it's right by my hip.
What?
And, he goes, get on the ground. I was like, oh, great. And me being, you know, stupid, I had just bought new shorts, like white, blue plaid. And the first thought in my head, I swear to you, was, well, that's grass. I'm going to get my new shorts dirty. And I had a gun. It was the most low-key robbery, armed robbery I've ever been. I've been involved in two robberies, been robbed twice. But that one was very low-key. I get on the ground. He takes, he goes, give me your money and give me your watch. So he got $50 and my watch, which I don't wear expensive watches. The other guy, same thing, about $50 and his even cheaper watch.
Mm-hmm.
And we go back and they don't believe us that we got robbed. We go back and we tell them and it's about 4 a.m. We finally get everything settled. We go to the police station, give them the whole story. I would tell you the story of the police station, but it's very non-PC. They're very new. They're not PC in Bahamas at all when it comes to what they want to say. About the robber, basically. They had video of him and all that. I guess it was because they saw us come out of the property and figured we're American, had money, crime of opportunity, I'm guessing. But a little did they know, they robbed the comedians, the two brokest guys in the Bahamas. Like, there's $27 million yachts in the marina. You're robbing us. I packed a suitcase full of food to eat down here for 2 weeks. robbing me. But the funny part was...
Yeah. They didn't look at the flyers.
No, they did not. So that club hears about it.
Yeah.
So they reimburse us the $50.
Oh, and cool.
You give me $100 for my watch. Well, my watch isn't worth $100. It's the Armatron is what I... And so basically, I made more money than the robber did.
Yeah, see? Now that's serendipitous right there. Justice! That's great. So those are
the two guys that come to mind.
Oh, my gosh. Well, yeah, I figured out 27 years, you'd have a few stories to tell, I would imagine. I would imagine. Got a few things. Now, all three of you have your own style in comedy. And I want to ask each of you, how would you describe your style? And if over time, has it evolved? And if so, how? Patrick, let's start with you.
This is all. What's up?
I just said, how would you describe it? Yeah.
This has always been my least favorite question about comedy, like completely in every possible avenue that's ever been asked of me. Because if you go and you compare yourself, if you're like, oh, well, it's kind of like so and so, well, you're not that person. So you're not, you know, that's not there. I've always like loved people like Mitch Hedberg, who were able to sit there and tell literally one liner after one liner that was completely unrelated. And I'm so jealous of people like that. You know, it's like, it's amazing. I don't know how his memory even did it, especially when you consider the life he had. But I'm not like that. I've never been something, I think, like more of a storyteller. And I would have to say that I have to tie in the question of how it's evolved, because when I first started, I was just going out and just thinking, okay, what funny stuff has happened to me? How do I sit there and relay that, you know, out there? Because most of the things that I think get the most laughter were genuine moments that happened in life. And I have to now repaint that picture for you. And so I think I'm like evolving into more of a storytelling comic, because in my most recent open mic, I went up there and I just talked for 5 minutes about the same topic, which I had never done. And I found that, you know, if you can at least, my opinion is, if you're at least engaging, it's better than sucking. And then if you get laughter, that's awesome too, you know, but it's like, just don't bore them. So I found that instead of hopping around from one thing to another, that I thought, okay, here's the, you know, 10 seconds to the laughter, another 20 seconds to the laughter. I was like, okay, why don't I just combine all these things? Why can't I make these things related? So the thing I'm hoping to become is someone who can sit there and talk for 10 or 15 minutes just about a wedding that I went to, and, you know, topically go all over the place, but the whole time we're still at that wedding, you know. And as someone who's like 34 now, I go to and have been to a ton of weddings. You know, 25 to 34 has pretty much been wedding season every year for me. So I'm trying to do my best to evolve into speaking like that. Because again, same in the book, you write a long monologue, you don't jump all over the place. You go and you do one long stretch of thing. Even a book at the end of the day is only about two or three things just told many different ways. So yeah, I would say that I'm evolving more into that. But as far as like going up there and just talking, like, you know, that's really what I am. I'm a storyteller who's trying to find a way to make my stories funny. You know, I want to be the only guy that you know that's had a raccoon break into his house and I got him out of the door with almond butter. You know, how I'm going to get you, how I'll get you to that moment is, you know, hopefully comically up to me. I wish the laugh was as quick as the one you just got, you know. It's so frustrating how long I've spoken of that moment on stage and not gotten the reaction you're giving me right now. I'm working.
Yeah. Well, see, it's already working for you. It's already evolving.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I know it's topically hilarious. You know, I don't know how to make that little guy funny for 3 minutes.
You can. I can think of a couple of comics off the top of my head that have a style like that. I've mentioned Nate Bargatze before in his dead horse routine. That's just famous for that kind of style. And then Sebastian's also incredible about his family.
Maniscalco?
Yes, yes.
Yo, yeah. No, he's great. He's incredibly active too.
Oh yeah, very physical comic. One of my favorite. Go ahead.
I've never seen a man dress as nicely as him and intentionally try to sweat. You know?
Exactly.
Like, that's what amazes me about him. He will dress up to the nines and then be like, I'm going to run around. It's kind of wild.
Yeah, he's incredible. I love his Chipotle story, and then his wife's the Canuba wax, where she wrecks the car and he has to take it to the shop and he describes the experience. Oh my goodness, you have to look it up. So good. So good. How about
David just cringed at the idea of a car wrecking.
No. Patrick, look
can up, I fix that?
Look up Norm Stoltz.
Norm Stoltz, will do, man.
Yeah, he's out of Michigan. He's a storyteller. His story is basically run about 45 minutes.
Yo, that's awesome.
The whole set
that's
is awesome. A story, and it's just laced with punchline after punchline after punchline after punchline. He's one of the early guys I worked with when I first started, and the owner I was at told me, watch this guy. And it's I don't do that, but it's amazing what he's able to do. If you want that style, it's a awesome style to be able to do.
Yeah, I'm amazed. When we talk about, you know, smart comedians, I'll mention a few. But yeah, I remember once the first time I did stand up, it was so tough because the guy that went on before me, he talked about, and I almost feel like I'm biased here because I'm such a fan of gummy bears, but he talked about like something like, I kid you not, I think he talked about gummy bears for like 4 to 5 minutes. And he was hilarious the entire time he did it. I'm trying to remember what his name was. I was so nervous about my own set that it escaped me, but he was great. And I was just like, yo, this guy just killed it. How am I going to get anything out of this crowd? You know? So yeah, I love that stuff.
That's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to watching you develop that, Patrick. I really am. I really enjoy stories. Yes, definitely. I really enjoy storytelling comics a lot. How about Paige? Paige, what's your comedy style if you had to describe it?
Ooh, well, let's see. Patrick's right. It is hard to describe your own comedy. I'm definitely a joke guy. I think it's like kind of just observational. Like I notice stuff during the day, and then I like sit down and like try to write as many jokes as I can, because that's the only way I know to do it, is just write as many jokes. I'm obsessed with like laughs for a minute, like as many laughs as you can like add into like the setup, the punchline, the ending, like how many tags can you add? I love just laugh after laugh after laugh, trying to write as efficiently as possible. That's what I like doing. But I do a little storytelling, but I definitely feel like I'm better at joke writing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been doing this 5 years in December, and I've known Paige pretty much that whole time. And I've watched, I mean, he was already good at word economy, and I've just watched that strength develop over time. So this show we're going to talk about in a little bit, the owner of the venue has specifically requested Paige be a part of the lineup because he's a favorite of the brewery owner. So that's why he's on it. Yeah, it's pretty cool. How about you, David? How would you describe your comedy style?
I started out very joke-oriented, just one-liner kind of thing. More observational. Now more observational relationship comic, I guess. And then I got to where I was writing individual jokes, and then it became sort of a story because now they all run together. So I got about marriage, since I have a divorce under my belt. A lot comes from that upbringing. And it's funny, most people describe comedy as observational. Most comics are observational. That's what we do. We observe the world and talk about it. It's a generic term, but it is true. What you observe and you put your spin on it, basically. So it can go from one-liner. It can go from short story. It can go from absurd. I kind of bounce all over the place. So I think it's probably more relationship now, generally. Is what it would be. It used to be more low key. Now it's morphed into a little more high energy. I've kind of learned it. I used to be very quiet and talk extremely fast, way faster than a Southerner ever should talk.
Is that even possible?
I had a guy from New York to slow down.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
I mean, it was bad. I mean, it's almost become mumbling because I was uncomfortable.
I see.
I was never a public speaker. So I've learned now to calm down. Slow down. I still have to say in my head, slow down, because the stuff I want to get out. And I used to be very uncomfortable with silence. So I built in silence into my show, or little portions of it where there's silence, so I could get used to it. So I've always kept that in there.
Yeah.
And so it used to be more low key. Now it's a little middle of the road. I can change my, you know, energy level as needed. I'm never off the wall. I don't bounce off the wall. I envy people who can do that.
Yeah.
Like Sebastian Maniscalco.
Yes.
go everywhere. That's what I thought I would be. And then when the lights hit me, just I stand and talk.
Yeah.
And
that's more your style. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. I don't if you had a spotlight on me, the guy would not get tired.
I got you. Yeah. That's good. I like how you said, you know, taking that time to be strategically silent, basically. I've noticed that too. People can relate to that. And you can also take that moment just to have a facial physical reaction to what you just said, which brings people right on in there connecting with you.
I was joke. And then in New York, you get flustered.
Right.
And so now I take the silence. And there was one show I did in Iowa. And there was I don't ever really go at the crowd at all, ever. But there was a lady who looked visibly upset at the show. And I thought something was wrong. And I stopped and I said, are you okay? You look upset. And she went, oh, I'm fine. I just don't find you funny.
Okay.
And I just, and it was, ooh, like
well,
that.
Well, all right then.
And I just went, oh, that's it? She goes, yeah. I said, oh, okay, we're fine. It didn't bother me. I'm like, oh, okay, good.
And she's okay. She
you don't have to find me funny. If you don't, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, not everybody is going to.
Right.
But later in the show, there was one joke that she liked and she laughed.
Oh, good.
And I was like, okay, there you go. And I found what you wanted. And I don't let that fluster me anymore. I don't let silence fluster me anymore. I try not to anyway. I can't say it always works.
Yeah.
But I try not to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really like that. That's really cool. Yeah. You know, we have so many great comics out there living today. Oh my goodness. They're so good. If I'm going to ask this to each of you, who are your top 3 to 5 comedians that are living today that make you laugh the most? Patrick.
All right. So the first two I'm going to name, way before I ever did comedy, got the chance to just serendipitously meet. And I already was a fan. And then I just became like, yo, these are amazing people. The first one is going to be Tracy Morgan. I met Tracy Morgan in an alleyway in New York City at like 11:30 at night on a weekend. And
what?
Yeah. Okay. So I was walking with, I'll try not to take time with this. I was walking down the alleyway and I was with some friends and they were from like Georgia, you know, super like Southern, you know, kids. And they'd only lived in the city for a few months. And we passed by this guy and, you know, there's homeless people everywhere in New York City. So it's like nothing to see this random strangers just sitting around. But this guy was on a windowsill. He had a phone to say he was texting, but that didn't strike me. I looked at his shoes and I was like, oh, those are really nice shoes for a bum. And I was like, that's kind of like they stuck out. And then he happened to look up at that moment. And I was like, yo, I know that face. And we kept walking. I told my friends, I was like, yo. I was like, we got to turn around. I said, I got to go talk to this guy. And they all looked down. All they see is just some shadowy figure sitting there. They were like, nah. I was like, no. I was like, I promise you, I'm not wrong. And up to him, I was just like, hey, Tracy. And he goes, yeah, what's up? And then I was just like, and I was like, what are you doing? And he goes, just chilling. And I was like, I see that. And I like asked him, I was like, and this was like when 30 Rock was being filmed, you know, like in the early days. And so I told him I'd heard him on Howard Stern before. I loved him. He, of course, went on about how, you know, he said some things I can't say. And then he, when I asked him, I was like, so what are you doing? It's like a Saturday night. It's, you know, you're just sitting here. And he goes, yeah. He goes, man, he goes, I'm just chilling. He's like, all of us famous people go out on Monday when all y'all got to work. And I was like, oh, man. And just his energy, everything about him. He's one of those people that he truly defined for me what it was when you're like, no. Like, if you meet him, you just know he was meant for something because there was nothing but just like energy just spewing out of him. And even the way, I mean, we asked some people to take a picture. They denied us just in like the typical stuck up New York fashion. And Tracy let him have it. It was really like, I for a moment was like, oh my God, am I about to get in a fight? Like, this is really awesome. You know, like, again, I wish I could repeat the things he said and I just can't, but it was really, really, it was so awesome. And then he took a picture with us. He was super cool. And then even when we left, I was like, all right, man, you have a good night. And he was like, yeah, travel well, y'all. And then just sat back down on the windowsill and just started texting again, like right next to trash bags. You know, he's just like the most humble, nice person ever. The next one I would say, and this goes with like, you know, Norm MacDonald. Mm. Norm MacDonald is, I think, one of the most clever people out there. And then we talk about storytelling, the ability for him to sit there and just, he can tell stories that aren't even his. you know, all these names and scenarios, and he'll just talk for, he's got like a 12-minute joke that doesn't even get to the punchline until the end, you know? And he's just like, which I know is how a joke works, but I mean, he literally doesn't scatter them throughout. He just like says funny things a little bit. And you're just like, oh my God, this is wild, but I can't stop listening. So when I met him too, I was living in Santa Monica and he happened to come out of the store that was near my house. And when I saw him, I was like, oh, I can't not say hello to that dude. I was like 23 years old. And he was the same thing. And I always thought it was an act. I was like, yo, that's his cadence. It's got to be fake. And when I was like, hey, Norm. And he's like, yeah, what's up, man? And I was like, oh my gosh, that's really him. And he was just super nice. Only talked for a minute or so because he had like a bad, I wasn't trying to bother him while he was like with his groceries. But he was just like, he was just, even when I mentioned Howard Stern, he goes, oh, Howard. Yeah, that guy. Like he just like, he was just so like, you know, just oddly humble. It was awesome. And then the other two, I would say like, you know, I love Dave Chappelle. I love Tina Fey. I mean, Dave Chappelle, I don't think I have to explain to anybody why he's like great. Tina Fey, although like, you know, she's way more of an actor comedian than she, is like a stand comedian. I think she's awesome. And the amount of emotion and the things she can express on that face are just awesome. When she used to do the Weekend Update, I think it was on SNL. I really liked her because she can come across in so many areas. It's great. So yeah, I would definitely like throw those people right at the top of my list of people who I'd love to just, you know, like pick their brain even more. And I find their comedy really awesome.
You know what I love about you, Patrick? I like how you go up to these famous people and like ask like their name, like you haven't seen them since high school.
well,
you're like, Tracy.
In fairness, Tracy, it was some, Norm I knew. Tracy, it was somewhat of a possible shot in the dark. I was like, maybe this isn't Tracy. Yeah. You know, but yeah, he was super, super cool. I loved them both.
Oh, that's so good. How about you, Paige? What top 3 to 5 living comedians make you laugh the most today?
Trying to think. Definitely, like, I'm a big fan of, like, Mark Norman and Joe List. Those guys are great. All the New York comics, really. It's, like, joke writers. You know, there's Sam Morril. Joe Mackey's really funny. Yeah, just joke writers. I love them. Yeah, that's probably it. I think I agree. Like Norm Macdonald is a genius. Like I love, cause there's a lot of like people like I consume content from, but don't necessarily their stand up isn't necessarily like a big factor for me, but it's like, I think they're super funny dudes. Yeah. So I like that there's a lot of different ways to be funny. And it goes back to like drawing cartoons as well as doing stand up. It's like, yeah, some people I really like the stuff they put out, but stand-up's not like a huge factor in what they do.
Okay. And they're making you laugh the other ways they're expressing their comedy and their craft.
Yeah. Well, like an example, like, I'm a big fan of like Tim Heidecker. If you've ever heard of Tim and Eric.
No, I have not. Please tell me about him.
Oh yeah. Well, he's they're like super influential. Tim and Eric, they're like super influential Adult Swim dudes, like super influential with all like alt comedy. Like he released a like pretty alt special that I loved this year. So it's like that's stand up, but like a lot of what I respect that he's done is more film and TV stuff. So I think it's cool to dip your toes in a little bit of everything. I like guys that do that.
So you probably like the Bo Burnham special this year.
I did. Yeah. I thought that was really cool. Yeah, totally.
That was wildly creative. Did the rest of you see that one yet? That is wildly creative. I highly recommend if you haven't seen it, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. That's using multi-forms of art to express comedy right there. So it's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. It's probably a way of trending, you know, a look into the future of what comedy might look like. So
for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, check it out. How about you, David? Who would be your top 3 to 5?
Mine, one that I will say, second what Paige said, I forgot about Sam Morril. I worked with him at a festival. That dude's amazing. He's not my top 5, but he would be on the cusp. He's ridiculous.
Agreed.
None of mine are famous. I have done stand-up for a long time, but oddly enough, when I started doing stand-up, I stopped watching it.
Really?
I don't watch on TV. I stopped watching. I didn't want to subconsciously pick up something I saw and regurgitate. So I know people that I've worked with, and
those
are my favorites. Generally, famous people are nowhere near my favorite list. Number one would be Brett Leake.
Okay. He's
kind of Louisa. He's done Tonight Show like 5 times. He's had a special on Entertainment Tonight about him. He's now a motivational speaker. He has muscular dystrophy. He is the cleanest comic you'd ever imagine. And will he works so hard at things. I worked with him and I got up at 9 a.m. He's ironing a shirt. I walk by the room. He goes, "You work on your act yet?" At 9 a.m. I'm thinking about breakfast. And this dude's already been up for 2 hours ironing, doing a punchline every iron stroke. I put him as one of the greatest writers in the history of stand up. And I'm including him with Carlin and Pryor.
Wow. I want to know this guy.
Brett Leake. He's phenomenal.
Okay.
He's amazing. And I met him when I first started doing stand up, like at 19. And I saw him. And we became friends. And he became like a mentor a little bit to me. I'm not as clean as him or nowhere near as funny. But it was fun learning from him. He taught me how to not look off my punchlines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, say it and turn around. He goes, "Give him a second and then move on." I learned that from him. Just little things. He watches everything. He remembers everything. Two would be Grant Turner. He was on the cusp of being famous. Never did. He became a character. He developed a character that was so good that no one knew it was him. People would ask for their money back because they paid to see Grant Turner and they didn't see him. The character was so good. Yeah. And Ricky Mocha was the character.
Okay.
Ricky Mocha, you've heard? Okay.
Yeah.
That's his character. He developed that. One of his best friends, a comedy club booker owner at the time, she was complaining about all the cheesy tape she was getting. So he made a point of making the cheesiest tape he could find. He went to the middle of a field with a newborn baby doing stand-up. She didn't know it was him.
Nice.
And they've known each other for 20 years. Didn't know it was him. She called him to say, "You will not believe what this dude just sent me." And it was him. It was he, that good. Let's see. Another one would be Billy Gardell from Mike and Molly.
Oh, yeah.
Powerhouse comedian. He's been doing it since he was 18.
Wow. He is
phenomenal and one of the nicest guys on the planet. We worked together when I was new. I was driving through Springfield, Missouri, where I would once a future in the future live, working the old Funny Bone there. And he was very nice to me. The feature I was emceeing, I was just driving through town. They needed somebody, so I stopped in. The feature was late. They couldn't wake him up. He came in late, was angry at everybody. Billy, before the feature got there, he goes, "Hey, Beck, how much time can you do?" I said, "I don't know, maybe 20. He goes, "Yeah, you do 20, bring me up, I'll do the rest." And we did it without the feature. The feature gets angry. He's rude to me all week. And he was from Canada, guitar guy, won't say his name. But he was always derogatory towards me all week. Mm-hmm. And it was World Series week. And we're at the hotel and I get a call from Billy. He goes, "Hey, Beck, you want to come to the room, get a pie, watch a series?" I was like, "Yeah, that sounds good." He goes, "Yeah, don't tell a Canadian." Just left him out of it. And we just watched the series. But he is unbelievably good on stage. Just natural, smooth. Other one would be Keith Auberstadt. Very good friend of mine. Also extremely funny. Probably the best Letterman set I've ever seen.
Oh, I have to see it.
The Letterman set is a masterpiece. I saw him tune it up at the Cellar in New York when I hung out there.
Oh, cool.
And he called me. He goes, "Let me know what you think." And I called him as soon as it was over. And I went, "Dude, that is the best thing I've ever seen on Letterman." To me.
Oh, I have to see it.
Phenomenal. And then it would be a toss-up. I'd probably say Robert Hawkins.
Okay.
I don't know how much stand-up he's doing anymore. He used to write for Christopher Titus on his show.
Oh, okay.
He is unbelievable. I worked with, I was in Boise, Idaho, starting out, and I was 27. And I drove all the way to Idaho from Virginia. It was me emceeing, and then Mark Gross,
yeah,
who is now a TV producer. And he was awesome, just amazing. And we have our shows. They went pretty well. Mark destroyed. Robert Hawkins goes up, and we're both just, our jaws drop.
Yeah.
And we're just like, "Oh, my God." And he hadn't been headlining very long, and he just destroyed the place.
Wow.
And Mark is like, "Who the hell is that guy?" he is unbelievable. All those guys. That list is long. I've worked with so many people. The list is freaking long.
Yeah, I bet it is. But those come top of mind. Yeah.
There are so many funny comics who aren't famous that it almost makes me angry that they're not.
Yeah.
You know, because they deserve to be.
Yeah, I see that. I see that producing shows. I can see that happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Mark. Yeah. He did pretty well. Yeah, from where we started when I met him, where it's in Boise, we were playing pool with two of the other staff members in the club. And if it's a sad story, but there was pickled sausage and pickled eggs on the bar. And we made a bet. Whoever loses has to eat one. Each player has to eat one or the other. We lost twice. And Mark about to puke eating the sausage. I'm eating the egg. And then we switch. I eat the sausage. He eat the egg. He about puking. I'm just eating it. He goes, "You like that?" I said, "You're from the South. That's breakfast." and then we started winning, and the other guys started getting sick after we started winning. But yeah, they're all really good comics.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to look some of those up. I'm looking forward to that.
I've always said I know so many good comedians. I'm surprised they let me do it.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
there's so much talent out there.
That's a compliment to people you've met. That's great. I like that. Well, here's my last question before we wrap up here and have people find out how they can follow you and all of that. It is, if you were Jerry Seinfeld and could pick up a comic in a cool sports car, spend the day with them to pick their brain and talk shop about comedy, who would you pick and why? Patrick.
That is such a hard question.
Right.
I want to say Norm Macdonald, but at the slow rate which he speaks, I'd only really get like a third of a day out of him. You know, I could just like it would be. I would need a week to really feel like I like gained much from the guy. Honestly, I think that it'd be really cool to talk to Jim Carrey for the reason of which is that if you watch his stand-up that he did like 20, 25 years ago, where he's wearing a bunch of crazy colored shirts and all that. And he goes on stage, and by the end of it, I mean, he's like dripping sweat. And I wish I could remember what that particular act was called. But I think about him, and same with like Chris Tucker too, as like two dudes who had the potential to be like killer stand-up comedians. And then Hollywood found them and they became actors, you know? And I would like really love to talk to Jim Carrey just about, you know, his early stand-up. I think that would be really cool. Kind of find out like how he felt, you know, his career could evolve, what he maybe thought would have, you know, gone differently if he had never made it into movies, because he was just so funny on stage and so natural and still his crazy self, which is, you know, different. You know, I think he'd be really cool. So that would probably be that guy.
Yeah, he is hilarious. One of my favorite movies he ever did was Liar, Liar, Liar.
Yo, not only that, he didn't just have like one. He had several home run movies that are all seemingly unrelated. You know, Ace Ventura is not like Liar, Liar, you know?
Exactly.
And then like, you know, I think the first Bruce Almighty is pretty good, you know? So it's just like the variety of ways he was able to do things, you know? And obviously he is a guy who really did sell himself a lot on the abilities that his face had, just, you know, to portray emotion. You know, I think that was really great, but I think his material was just really good. And I would have loved to have seen what that guy would have done if he would have done 2 hours or 3 hours of like straight stage time.
Yes.
But he's clearly a deep thinker.
Yes, he is. And also just his characters, his Fire Marshal Bill is probably my favorite character that he's ever done.
I don't even know.
That.
See, no, that's the thing. There's so much of them. I don't even know.
Okay.
That
so you must Google this. Then.
Yeah.
You must
I will.
Fire Marshal Bill, Jim Carrey. I'm just saying.
I will.
Enjoy the experience.
Yeah.
Am I right, David?
You are. And I think he's underrated for one thing is people don't realize how hard it is to be that on cue.
Yeah.
He does on cue. They think, oh, that has got to be insanely difficult to do that.
Yeah. Maybe that would be part of it too, that energetic release that's required. You know, maybe that was just something that he was like, okay, he goes, I can go do this on a film for 2 hours and then just not have to do that again. Like, I don't know if that would, I would be so curious to see like, yo, did you just feel like it would drain you too much? Mm-hmm. Cause yeah, he's so alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think another way the two of you would connect is before we started this interview, you were showing me, Patrick, your office and you do art. Right. So you have some art in your office and you do that. He does that too. He's an artist now.
I've seen some of his paintings are like the size of an entire house. It's crazy. And yeah. He's done really, really big pieces of work. It's ridiculous. I would love to know what his like monthly budget on paint is.
Yeah. Yeah. He can definitely afford the big canvases.
Yes. Yes, he can.
Yes, he can. How about you, Paige? Who would you pick up if you were Jerry Seinfeld and hang out with for a day?
Yeah, I think it'd be fun to do someone like really crazy and like weird. Like especially if I'm Jerry Seinfeld, I'm not myself. I'd love to pick up like Gallagher and just like,
oh yeah,
go on a joyride and smash like mailboxes with his hammer. I think that'd be great.
That is so Paige right now, and I'm loving this answer.
And asking him about his process is like, so what's your process? It's like, well, I buy a watermelon and I just smash it with a hammer. Wow.
Because that's a thing, you know.
Yeah.
That's really cool. How about you, David?
Mine, well, I was going to say Jim Carrey, because the whole thing behind Ace Ventura was he basically bought that script, rewrote it, and did it himself.
What?
Yeah,
no, I did not know this.
He redid that whole movie.
Oh my gosh.
That was one of my favorite, because I'm a Dolphin fan too, so that didn't hurt.
Yeah, definitely doesn't hurt.
But yeah, so that I'm not gonna say that. I would have to go back in time. But first, since we're saying we're gonna go in a sports car, for me, we gotta say which sports car.
Oh yes, we do. Yes, we do. So let's talk about that.
I'm not as rich as Seinfeld, but I also don't like Porsches. mine would be a Pontiac GTO. Specific one, 1970 Judge Starlight Black Rammer 4. There we go. You may not hear the interview because the car is too loud, but it would be an amazing car to show up in. mine, I'd have to go back in time. I heard so much about this guy when I was on the road, never got to work with him. Richard Jenny.
Okay.
I heard he was phenomenal in the clubs. He never really got big in the movies. He was in it, you know, in what was it? The Mask. He was in that with Jim Carrey.
He was.
And Walrus Man, some other stuff. But I always heard he was the most energetic and one of the most phenomenal club comedians ever. So I would love to go back in time and talk to him, because my life was pretty much in the clubs. I would never be famous like these other people.
Right.
But what's it like for him?
Yeah.
You know, because he existed in the clubs mostly.
And booking all the time if he's that good. Yeah.
He was phenomenal in the clubs. I would love to have been able to meet him and pick his brain and talk to him.
That's really great answers. I got to get to know some of these comedians.
Yeah. Jim Carrey's amazing. I do love some Jim Carrey. I got to hop in on the Jim Carrey love train.
You do it, Paige.
I love him because especially he's right. Like, he was amazing in the clubs, and it's like, especially like doing weird characters in clubs. Like, nowadays you can like book like kind of whatever show if you want to do like an indie show, but it's like doing weird characters in clubs and like making it really, really work. It's so impressive.
Yeah. And by the way, I would agree with you on Gallagher, by the way. I never met him, but I was connected to him in one way. My first ex-girlfriend that I had friends years ago, her grandfather was a huge Gallagher fan.
Yeah.
Her grandfather died of cancer. When he was in the hospital bed, basically his deathbed, I called Gallagher's agent. And I said, if you could you send a signed headshot to her grandfather? Gave him the address. It was there the next day. He had it on his nightstand beside his bed when he passed.
Oh, now I have goosebumps. That. Yeah. That's
and
wonderful.
They still have that picture. My friend still has that picture.
What a heartwarming story.
Yeah. I know. I love Gallagher, but now I'm more in love with him.
Yeah, it was cool. He sent it lickety-split, signed specifically to him.
I love
that. So cool.
It was cool.
Before we go, David, can I ask you a question? Because you'd have more likelihood than any of us here to have gotten to see this. I've heard of another comedian who we all know, but that they say that his, you know, the persona we see, but then him in a club is just a way different version. I've heard Jay Leno live doing stand-up is actually like you would never realize that that's the person that goes on TV.
I have heard that. I've never met him. I was working in a casino in Pennsylvania. He was actually there in the big showroom. I was in the comedy club downstairs. He was going to come down because he's a huge car guy. I just wanted to talk cars with him.
For yeah.
7 years. But yeah, I've heard that too, that the Tonight Show thing was just a progression for him. But he also made his living solely on, he never spent a dime of his Tonight Show money. I think we've all heard that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On his stand-up.
Yep.
If you can do that, and I mean, yes, he's famous, and yes, he gets a lot of money for that, but if you don't have the chops to back it up, they're not going to book you.
Well, and there's like no videos of him out there performing. You can't find Jay Leno doing stand-up on the Jay Leno show.
That's interesting. I've never looked, but I've heard he was phenomenal too. I would love to meet him.
Yeah. And the last one, since you mentioned going there when you were younger, I more or less just looked for confirmation on this one. Was Boise State as cool of a hidden gem then as it is now? I find it to be the most underrated city.
Yeah, Boise is a great city. The hotel I stayed in was the Idenhaw. It's like 100 years old, back in 1997 or 98 when I worked there. The back behind the Capitol was just rolling mountains. The football field for Boise State, like, you know, was blue. The reason that they it's blue, but they had to they almost changed it because birds kept diving into it, thinking it was water.
Dude, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No. I really want to
have bird beacon around it to keep them from doing that. It's a really. Yeah. It was for one of my first road gigs. I went from Virginia to Green Bay, took a week off, camped in between in Iowa and Nebraska, and then went to Boise. And I had no money, but it was the best road experience for me. It was my first time on the road for 3 weeks. I didn't think I was going to make it home because I didn't know what the road life was like. I was gone for 3 weeks. I came home with $30. I did not know if I would have enough gas money to get home because I was like, oh, I'm going to eat out here and do this and do that. And then I had to fix my car. Needed a CV boot. Yep, I had to get that done. And I was worried about getting home. That's when I realized comedy is a business and you have to actually ask what you're getting paid.
yes. No idea.
But yeah, it was. And the two people I worked with out there would be Mark Rose and Robert Hawkins. Watching those two shining examples of stand-up, I was like, good Lord, how good those people. And the lady that ran the club was awesome. She trained her audience as well. I mean, that's when I was from Virginia. I started in Virginia Beach, basically. On the way out there, I realized none of this local stuff's going to work. I had to rewrite. I rewrote everything on the way out and wrote new stuff. On the way out west, I was stop on the side of the road and just have to write at a rest area because I thought of something on the way out there. And I hadn't been on stage in 8 days. I was camping, basically talking to myself in a tent. I'd been on stage in the first.
Did you kill? Did you kill?
No, I've never said those words. I've never said kill or crush.
Okay.
I had a lot of fun.
Okay. The
crowd was fantastic.
Yeah.
Everything I did worked the first thing to the last one. And to the point where Mark Gross went, hey, thanks for making me work, dude. You know? And I was like, I had to get it out. And you know, if you're off stage too long, that you have to get it out.
Yeah.
And you just explode when you're trying to get something and you haven't talked to someone in so long. And the crowd, it wasn't all me. The crowds are so well trained there at the time that you can do no wrong. The crowds were the Lisa Young was the manager at the time. She trained. She never brought the same comic in twice. It was always different styles of comics and all, you know, she never trained her audiences for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they trained to listen.
It was
really, really good.
Well, and it's like, I mean, I only went to drive through Boise and some people I met in Seattle. So I could stay there. I ended up staying there almost a week. But I also find that they're so far from everything else. There is like a starvation of entertainment there. You know, I think they would just be, they're like, yeah. Like, you know, we're good. We'll sit here. You know, listen, I remember going there and just watching a few people do comedy. And I don't remember, like, you know, I didn't have the same experience that you did where I got to see like crowd after crowd after crowd. But yeah, I felt like, it was such a cool room. And I was like, yo, this is in Boise. You know, I was like, I never expected that. I absolutely love that city. It was really cool.
It is a really cool city. The street food after the show was over. Was really cool. I'm a I love food. So I was in my element. I just like everything. So I just, that's what I miss about the road the most, traveling as much as I was going to all these different places and checking out all the different scenes and foods and everything else.
When'd you go to Boulder? I was, it was summer of 2016.
Okay. Was it Liquid Lash you went to?
Probably. I would need to actually like look at like a photo.
I think it took over
the football tag, but I believe there weren't like a lot of spots to go. There might've been two places.
No. When I moved to the Midwest, I worked the Midwest more anyway than the East Coast. Mm-hmm. The Midwest, I always found they seemed to be better audiences because they were ready for it. They're not jaded by a glut of entertainment.
Absolutely. New York audiences are way less appreciative of, they're like, oh, we got 20 other people to choose from tonight. Please move on.
Yeah, we've seen 14 superstars already. What do you got?
I mean, it's a totally different game. But either way, I just wanted, I'm always interested to hear if I'm the only person that loves Boise or if, everyone is just in on the secret.
It makes a good argument to move there. It's a cool city.
Agreed. And that football field is really trippy. Seeing that in person, it's wild. It's really wild.
It is.
So you get not just great, engaging conversations with comedians on the Virginia's for Laughers podcast show, but you get vacation tips. And I think the word today is Boise.
You know what food is, I can probably tell you.
Yeah, this has been so great. As we wrap up here, can each of you share with our laughers how they can follow you on social media or otherwise? Paige, we'll start with you. Rick, how can they follow you?
I'm Uncle Paige on everything, pretty much. Twitter, Instagram. I do a live show on Instagram, Sundays at 6, DP. So if you want to watch that, you can follow me there. And then, I also do TikTok, Uncle Page 420. That's the only one that's not Uncle Page. That's about it.
Okay, great. And how about you, Patrick?
I'm hoping that you'll have my last name spelled somewhere on the tag. Yes. But everything is going to be just Patrick DiMarchi. It's DiMarchi. You can figure out the Patrick part. And that's where you can find me on pretty much any platform available that I'm on.
Okay. And David Beck?
I'm the hardest one to follow because I did a social media detox. I'm pretty much off everything but YouTube. It's youtube.com/whoisdavidbeck. Some videos up there. I left Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all of it. And it's, I noticed one side effect of that is people think you're dead. You leave that. Oh my God, he must have died or something. I don't know. Yeah. Like a week.
Well, we will put that information and YouTube link in the show notes as well, and remind people that you are very much alive.
Yeah,
you get here.
Thank you. I think some high school friends are wondering.
Well, we are here to remind them. Thank you, Patrick, Paige, and David. This has been super fun. I loved having each and every one of you on here today.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
that was cool. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And laughers, you can catch Patrick, Page, and David perform September 18th at 7 p.m. at Restless Moons Brewing, located at 120 West Wolf Street in Harrisonburg. No tickets to purchase for this show. Just show up to join us for all the laughs and buy more beer instead. We'll be sure to put this info in the show notes as well, along with the website link to the brewery, and we will see you there. And lastly, and most importantly, thanks for tuning in, laughers. Out of all the podcasts out there, you picked us, and we think that's pretty darn special, just like you. Until next time, keep smiling. Bye.
Bye.
Better guys.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by X2 Comedy. We'll be dropping a new podcast every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, so check back for another uplifting episode. Come to an X2 Comedy show or let us bring a show to you. To find out more, head to x2comedy.com. Be sure to share us with a friend. Until next time, cheers.